This is the Tenino Valley Historical Society's meeting of October the 28th, 1964, and our speaker for the evening will be Harry Aaron.
Distinguished member of the Fairbanks community, it's Justice Harry O. Aaron who will tell us about early days here in Fairbanks.
Well, it's really a privilege and a pleasure for me to be here in a restful attitude among friends after being raked over the coals like I have been for taking money out of the mouths of babes and depriving American citizens of the right to trial by jury.
Will you state your name here so we can get it on record?
Oh, I'll be very happy to. Harry Oscar Arend, A-R-E-N-D.
Where were you born?
I was born in Spokane, Washington, about the time that Felix Pedro was running around up here looking for that gold, 1903.
Your age? Your mother and father's name?
My father was William Fred Arend. My mother was Ida Augusta Szymanski. My parents were both born in Germany, immigrated to this country, and met in Spokane, and that's where I was born. I learned to speak German before I spoke English, and it wasn't until my brother and I went to school, started school, and learned English that my mother picked it up from us. I'm very happy that I've retained my knowledge of German. I was in Germany 2 years ago and visited some of my relatives who are still living there. I was able to converse with them. I was surprised to find that most of the young people could speak better English than I could German. Well, to get at some of my Alaskan experiences, I first heard of Alaska in 1916 when I joined the Boy Scouts in Spokane, and our scoutmaster had just come down from Ketchikan, Alaska. Now, I remember he had a parka. What he ever used it for in Ketchikan, I don't know now, but he did display it to us, and he told us that Ketchikan was the place where you catch all you can all you catch. So that stayed with me through the years. I knew a man who ran a bookstore in Spokane. He told me of the time that he had been in the Yukon and Alaska and had ridden a bicycle from Dawson to Nome, and I just couldn't believe it. But I have been told since by the old-timers that that was not unusual. There was a well-beaten trail in March, and many foot travelers made the trip, and some rode bicycles. Now, perhaps some of you can verify that.
Yeah, I can verify it.
My father came up to Ketchikan in 1926, and the following year he came to Fairbanks, and he wrote me glowing accounts of Fairbanks and all the opportunities here for a young lawyer. But it took 6 years before I took the bait. In 1932 and 33, I was practicing law in Vancouver, Washington. Money was scarce, very scarce. I remember we took potatoes and butter and eggs for fees as lawyers. There just wasn't any money around. Then in the summer of 1933, I had made application. I'd had some experience in the secondary school systems in Washington. I made application and just by chance wrote to Nenana, Alaska. And I got an offer to come up there at $200 a month. Oh, that was stupendous. As a matter of fact, one of the lawyers, young lawyers in the office where I was doing my business, said to me, "Look, Nobody knows you from me up there. How about letting me go in your place and I'll send you a percentage on that salary? I don't know, maybe. He is now a judge of the state of Washington. Maybe I should have taken him up and I wouldn't be in the predicament I am right now. Well, I came. And oh, those were the days to travel to Alaska, if you know it. You got on the boat on Saturday in Seattle. You arrived in Seward about Friday, and you had that leisurely trip. Get acquainted with everybody on the boat, and I also found that everybody knew, and everybody in Alaska knew who was coming into Alaska every week, because you got the passenger list. And so people would meet you at the train. I arrived in Enana, would meet you at the train, shake hands with you, call you by your name. And that amazed me. There were quite a few school teachers on that boat that I came up on, and also quite a few tourists. This was in August. We arrived in Enana on the 26th of August. And I remember we got there at 5 o'clock in the morning. There was frost on the board sidewalks in Enana. We came on the Brill car. That's why we got there that early in the morning. That Brill car, remember how it used to bounce along? Somebody said goes 50 miles an hour, 25 miles ahead and 25 up and down. And I believe it, because if you ever traveled on the Brill car. Well, on the boat, some of the old-timer Alaskans, you know, they used to do a lot of kidding with the chechakos. I don't know whether that's still being carried on or not. But the lady teachers that were going to Nenana, they said, they were asked, where are you going? Well, we're going to Nenana. Oh, you want to be careful. That's Nenanaw. Oh, no, that's Nenana up there on the Tananaw River. Well, you've got that wrong, too. It's the Tanana River. So the girls arrived there, and they were telling everybody how happy they were to be in Nenanaw. Well, that isn't unusual when you hear Minchuman pronounce Minchumina. I remember once a radio announcement came from the Richfield Reporter in California that Dr. Benelli was visiting down there. I'm very happy that I had a chance to live in a small community when I first arrived here, because you really get the feel of Alaska in these smaller communities. And Nenana was a small community then, about 400 people, of about half of whom were white and the rest had native blood. Many of the children were in the territorial school, were half and quarter. And I was very happy to find out that their intelligence was on a par with the whites, that you just couldn't tell any difference. Deaconess Thompson, who was teaching in the mission at Nenana, told me that that did not run true among the full-blooded natives, that they seemed to be able to comprehend, especially in mathematics, up to about the sixth grade. Well, I have since found out that that is no indication of intelligence whatsoever, the fact that they don't comprehend arithmetic. They don't have any, and haven't had any use for arithmetic beyond what you get in the sixth grade, so why should they be interested in these involved mathematical problems? I met a lot of old sourdoughs there. I remember Captain Pulte. I wonder if anybody ever got any statement from him. Captain Pulte was with that expedition to the Arctic in 1881, and he was living on a pension in Nenana when I was there. Quite a character in this respect. I would meet him 50 below on the street in Nenana, dressed just like I am now. I asked him one day, I said, aren't you afraid of freezing to death? And he said, no. He was sent on a mission for help the steamer they were on got into trouble. I don't know whether it was even a steamer in 1881. Probably was. And so they had to go for help, and he was the only one who survived the trip inland for aid and got back because he was able to withstand the weather. Doctors had told him afterwards, who examined him, that he was constituted in such a way that his blood vessels were pretty well embedded in his skin, and that's why he was able to withstand so much more cold than ordinarily. You know, one thing I miss is the nicknames. You don't hear them anymore like we used to. I remember there was Whiskey Jack and Hatless Joe. Remember Hatless Joe around town here? And there was one character, Sam White probably remembers him, Whiskers Bill. Whiskers Bill was a ne'er-do-well and a vagrant. Some of the time he would be found sleeping up at the dog kennels. And he had a big beard, so we called him Whiskers Bill, and about once a month the police would pick him up and bring him to the federal jail, especially in the winter, to keep him from freezing to death on a vagrancy charge. Then for about two or three months I didn't see Whiskers Bill. And one day I said to Steve McCullis, who was a deputy marshal, "What's happened to Whiskers Bill?" And he said, "Whiskers Bill, whom do you mean?" So I described the man to him, and Steve says, "Oh, you mean No Whiskers Bill." What had happened, he had shaved his whiskers, and his new nickname was No Whiskers Bill. When I arrived in Nenana, like many Chichacos, I was told a lot of things that some of which I believed and others I discredited. One thing that concerned me was what would happen to a person if he died there in Nenana in the winter time. So I should never have done it, but I asked some of these smart high school boys in school what happened. And they said, "Well, haven't you ever been down to the NC warehouse?" And I says, "No, what about that?" "Well, they hang them up by the hawks there until spring." Well, you know, I didn't know whether to believe that or not, so I told an old-timer what the kids had told me. And he says, "Oh, they're pulling your legs." "That's a good one." So I said, "Well, what do they do with the old-timers? Or with anybody that dies in the wintertime?" And he looked at me and he says, "Why, we just point them off and drive them in." I used to love to tell that story outside when we were out in 49 to 54. And invariably, if at a gathering like this, when I told the story, somebody would come up afterward and say, "Mr. Aaron, what do they do with them up there?" And I would say, "Well, you wouldn't believe it if I told you," and let it go at that. But there were many such interesting stories. I remember one family there. The father went with a neighbor to cut wood in the wintertime, and his wife always cooked up in a wash tub soup for them to take along. They'd be gone probably a week. And this man told me, I said, "What do you do with that soup?" "Oh," he said, "we go out there and we work while it's daylight. And then we go in and we chop off a piece of soup and have our dinner," which was a very convenient way of doing it. We had comparatively primitive conditions. One year I did live in one of the railroad commission houses, but the other year we lived in a cabin down there, and just like I suppose 50-60 years ago the people had to live, we lived under those conditions and thoroughly enjoyed it. We found out that we could take it. I'm happy that I had a chance to know many of these old timers. Well, as a matter of fact, I just turned 39 last Monday. So it was a great experience to know them, and there were many of them. I don't know if any of you remember the old man that had the homestead down in Happy Creek. What was his name? The old, he was a farmer down there. He owned a number of big claims that he finally leased. Was it Greg? Berg.
Berg. He was on the riverbank.
He was on, oh. Well, anyhow, you know that he was inducted into the Union Army at the age of 14 and put in the cavalry. It was interesting to him to hear him tell stories, because not only had he been a pioneer here in Alaska, but he had been a pioneer in the on the plains down in the lower 48. Now, he had a wealth of information, but I didn't realize how important it was at that time, or I would have tried to get him to give an account of his experiences. Frank Buteau, did any of you know him?
Yes.
Now, Frank, I understood, came to Alaska about 1886. He was a French-Canadian, and he died here around in the middle 30s, I believe.
He's a blacksmith for the Inseco.
Was he? I didn't know that.
Frank Buteau.
Yes, yeah. Frank Buteau.
Yeah, I worked with him.
French-Canadian. Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that I'm interested in is genealogy. I have, through our church, I got the young folks to go out and get the names off all the monuments and little markers, whatever there's left in both cemeteries. And on top of that, we were able to obtain from Mr. Thomas, Merle Thomas, the old records that Hosey Ross kept with the names and a little description in most cases, whether sometimes it says Mason or it says Elk. Sometimes it gives the trade or profession that he followed. Those things we have sent to Salt Lake City. The Mormon Church, as you may have heard, is gathering genealogical information from all over the world, and I think they have now the largest genealogical library anywhere. We have been permitted to go into countries, even into Poland, and microfilm all of their genealogical records, birth certificates, death certificates, marriage certificates. We get the government to let us come in, we microfilm them, and then the records don't even leave us. We then send back a roll to the country for their archives, which will of course be much easier to preserve than these records. Some of the records are already brittle and frail. We have built tremendous vaults in the mountains there, in the Wasatch Mountains around Salt Lake City, where these records are being stored. And there are millions and millions of sheets on the microfilm. And if you ever get interested in genealogy, don't go all over the world trying to follow your ancestors. Go first to Salt Lake City, and the library there will help you to get started. My mother and father, as I say, were both born in Germany. I was fortunate enough to find a man in Salt Lake City who had been born in Germany and was a trained genealogist, researcher in Germany. And then he joined the Mormon Church, and he came to Salt Lake City, and he's been employed by many people there to run their genealogies. I've had him do quite a bit of work for me. While the errand line, I was only able to go back to 1611 to the present time. But on one of my other lines, I've been able to go back to 1382. You'll be amazed at the perfect records that were kept by the churches. And also, now in England, you'll find the parish records. Many of these, in Germany, for instance, Hitler was so determined that he was going to get people to forget their family ties and feel their tie to the state that he gathered up a lot of these records and was going to destroy them so that people would not be able to trace their ancestry. However, he committed suicide before he completed that job, so we were able to get to microfilm those records. In other places, they have been destroyed. In Poland, we found a tremendous lot of records. On my mother's side, I was not able to find much because she was born in Germany on the Polish border, where she probably, her family acquired the ski, Szymanski. Szyman is a German name, but ski is a Polish, like John's son, O'Connell, all meaning son of. Now, the reason I mention this, I'm sure this historical society will be coming across a lot of names, and 100 or 200 years from now, somebody may be working on his genealogy, and he finds a blank because one of his ancestors, whom he's trying to establish connection with, was in Alaska, died here, and there's no record anywhere of what happened to him. It's amazing how all over the country people are interested in genealogy. There's a Heston family in Illinois. They accumulate volumes and volumes and pages and pages. Among their clan is Charlton Heston, a great movie actor. He played the part of Moses, you know. And they have generals and politicians, even a beauty queen in their line. So you see how it becomes very interesting to do this work. Well, I was admitted to practice law here in Alaska in 1934 by Judge E. Coke Hill, whom you probably all remember. A very fine old gentleman who spent his declining years in San Francisco. I believe he lived to be over 90. Another man whom you all knew was John McGinn. He also lived to a very great age. Judge Clegg. E.B. Collins, the veteran of the bar, who's still living down in Sitka. Sam and I had a lot of interesting experience. Sam was our best field marshal that we ever had up in this country. Sam, did you take that warden from Connecticut? Were you the one that took him out sightseeing? Oh, well, there was we picked up a man right in the early part of the war in Nome. Unfortunately, he got drunk one night, and they put him in jail overnight and took his fingerprints. About 2 weeks later, here comes a letter from the FBI in Washington. They want this man. He and a friend of his had just gotten out of the army in the World War I, had gone into a tavern and gotten into an argument with the tavern owner and killed him. They were both sentenced to life imprisonment. This man had spent around 20 years in prison and was finally paroled on condition that he not leave the state of Connecticut. Well, times were bad in Connecticut at the beginning of the war there, and he heard about opportunities in Alaska, so he came up to Alaska and went to Nome. And that's what I say, the FBI wanted him because he had jumped his parole, see. And when it was found out that he was up here, he was picked up and brought to Fairbanks. It was the assistant warden from the Connecticut Penitentiary who came up here for him. He was wined and dined up here and given a good time. One day, John Noble, FBI agent, and I had him in the office, and we said, now, just why did you come up here? Here, this fellow, he spent 20 years in prison. He's harmless now. He looked to be 60, and he was only in his 40s. Why do you want him back there? And this warden looked at us, and he said, I'll tell you what. He's our star second baseman, and we got a big game coming up with Rhode Island Penitentiary next year, and we just got to have him back. Then the Marshal Joe McDonald used to take the visitors out to his cab, his house on, what was it, 2nd Avenue? I think on 2nd Avenue. And show them the corn. He had corn growing in his backyard. They didn't know that the city steam pipes ran underneath the ground there. And that's where the ground was warm enough to raise corn. Incidentally, I must tell you one more story and then I'll quit. I heard a couple of old-timers in Nenana discussing the qualities of the Idaho potato and the Alaskan potato. And one sponsored Alaska potatoes, one sponsored Idaho potatoes. And the fellow, they were both old sourdoughs. The one was complaining. He says, well, you know, these Alaskan potatoes, they got all these black spots in them. And the old sourdough looked at him. He said, don't you know what those are? And he said, no. What are they? Well, that's them vitamins you've been reading about. Well, that concludes my little dissertation here. It's been a pleasure to be with you, and if I can ever be of any help in trying to
get...
Well,
won't you tell us what you came up to Nenana for?
That year, I taught school there. I was the principal of the school at Nenana. I taught high school, all the subjects in high school, except typing. I just couldn't master the typewriter, so I had my 8th grade teacher come down and teach typing. But I taught everything.
What years were those? 1933, 34, and 35. That's right. I think I first spotted you. I was a college student out here.
Were you at that time?
You were the superintendent or principal down here.
Well, when you practiced law, you were the district attorney afterwards, weren't you?
Well, yes. Here's what happened. I would come up every summer, and I opened up an office here just to get acquainted. And I sat in that office and studied Alaska law, and also took a course in bookkeeping so I could teach bookkeeping the next year. And gradually I got acquainted. In 35, I picked up several cases, which I worked on during the summer, and I had to get excused from school once or twice to come up here. And incidentally, I drafted an ordinance for Nenana, the city council down there, which prohibited the owners of the dog teams to drive their teams on the sidewalks. They were using the sidewalks and the people were walking out in the road, so we drafted an ordinance to take care of that situation. In 36, I stayed and opened up a law office here. In 38, Ralph Rivers asked me if I'd be interested in applying for the Assistant United States Attorney's position here, and I did. I was with Ralph till 44, and then he ran for Attorney General of Alaska, and I received the appointment as United States Attorney. I was reappointed in 1949. In the spring, but in the fall, Mrs. Aaron was having some difficulty at that time with arthritis. So Tom Clark, who was the Attorney General of the United States at that time, arranged a transfer for me to Los Angeles in the Antitrust Division. I was very happy for that experience. I was down there 5 years, and we really had some rough times with the big boys down there. We were in this big West Coast oil case in which we were trying to break up a monopoly that the 7 major oil companies on the West Coast had. I worked on that case for 5 years. I finally got so weary, and we had such a great longing to get back up here, that I resigned. The case was finally, it went another 7 years, and was finally settled by what they call a consent decree. The companies came in and agreed that they would quit doing this and quit doing that, and we put them under a judgment so that they had to do that. It was a great experience, and it's been very helpful to me in my position now on the bench, because I can understand the problems of the lawyers, and of course the problems of the people and the corporations too. They have their rights that have to be taken care of, as well as the people. Thank you.
Mr. Aaron.
Yeah.
How many brothers and sisters have you?
There were five of us in our family.
Name them.
My brother was a twin, my oldest brother. They were twins, but the twin died. His name was Henry. My brother's name was William Fred, just like my father's. My brother was up here in 38 to about 42. He had had rheumatic fever as a young man, and that had affected his heart. We couldn't get him to slow down, and he just couldn't be restful. He always had to be up and doing something, and it wore down his heart. He died here in 1942. I had a sister who lived to be only 8 years of age, and then there was another baby that did not grow to maturity.
What was your most interesting case in those years in Fairbanks?
My most interesting case? Well, I tell you, there were two. One was Huldah Ford's estate, and the other was Dr. Bunnell's estate. I handled those two, and I really learned something about everything. I'd say those two. Of course, we prosecuted a lot of criminal cases.
I remember some of them. You remember the murder of the family down on the railroad that summer?
Sawage
family. And then the murder of the two men down on the
Little Gershel.
You
were, yeah,
with
the
remember
axe.
That?
Yeah.
That was an interesting case. We went to trial on that case, and the jury found the man guilty of killing two men with an axe. The verdict was guilty of first-degree murder. Warren Taylor was the attorney, and he appealed the case. When we went down to San Francisco to argue the appeal, I remember the judges looking at Warren, and they said, "Well, now, Mr. Taylor, did you ever stop to think that if we reverse this decision and send it back for a new trial, that your man may not get off so easily?" And the next time we had the death penalty then, you know. And Warren, you know, he said, "We'll take our chance on that." And they came back 2 years later. We tried the case with a different jury. The verdict was guilty of manslaughter as to one of the men who was killed, and not guilty on the other. So that's the difference that 2 years will make in sentiment.
Judge, could I ask you a question? In regards to this Sawage murder affair, I don't recall the man's name that killed those people, but I thought, maybe I'm mixed up, that's why I'm asking, that they take that fellow from down Lower Goldstream over onto Hester Creek and got it into an old load.
You're right. We never had to try that case, but we were interested in the attendant circumstances. You're right. What happened? The officers went out after him. The FBI, the marshal's office, and I think some of the game commission boys went out with
Rhodes.
Yeah,
they smoked him out.
And what happened? He went into this tunnel, and the boys were outside, and they ordered him to come out. He refused to come out, so they built a fire in front of the tunnel. And when they went in after him, he had expired, as I remember, from the smoke. I want to say this for our law enforcement officers. They were brave men. They laid outside of that tunnel, and they said among themselves, "Now, look, you don't have a family. You better go in." Okay. So that man went up to the tunnel and started the fire. I won't say which one it was, because they were all brave. I'm sure any one of them would have gone, but they just talked it over. You might be interested to know that John Noble, after his 3 or 4 years up here, and he was an excellent FBI agent. He worked on his own, you know. He knew how to handle cases. After he left here, he was called into Washington, D.C.
Mr. Hoover wanted to talk to him personally. He knew him. He said, John, who do you have depending on you? Well, my mother. You don't have a wife? No. You don't have any children? No. Well, you're just the man we want. There are rumors that Hitler escaped to South America and you're going down after him. And that was John's next assignment after he left here. We had some wonderful FBI agents here, as Sam will probably say. Well, they had to be good men. They had to be men who could be trusted, because they were alone. They weren't under supervision. When I was in San Diego in the U.S. Attorney's Office, they used me 8 months down there to try to help them out with their office in San Diego. We had 50 FBI agents, and I think 40 of them were young men who had just joined the force. And they needed a lot of training. They would come in with cases a cinch, and you'd sit down, you begin to ask them questions about the case, and they gradually realized they had nothing to go on. But they learned fast.
They all have to be trained lawyers, don't they?
Lawyers or public accountants. Yes, they must have graduated in business administration or law, because they can use them in both fields.
They call them to look for fraud, is that the idea?
They do a lot of that, tax evasion. Yeah. In these antitrust cases, we found out that the big corporations no longer put their conspiracies to fix prices in writing. They do it in the club or on the golf course, and it's pretty hard to work up a case. In one case, the FBI agents went in and the files were all empty. The folders were there, but the files were empty. And in going through the files, they found a note that the secretary had left. She forgot to take it out. It said, this file is to be destroyed because we're expecting an FBI investigation.
I thank you very, very much. Judge Aaron, we enjoyed this very, very greatly, your talk, and you hope you'll be with us.
Thank you.
At all the other, many other meetings.
This concludes.